so coy, alluring. Angel with a wicked smile. Sleeping 20 hours a day. Never lay a paw on dusty clay. I'll keep your litter natural. No chemicals in your nostrils. Just corn below. So every time you go, you'll know your shh don't stink.
World's best cat litter for the world's best cat.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
You're listening to Power Athlete Radio, a podcast dedicated to empowering your performance every damn day. Join former NFL pro and Power Athlete founder John Wellborn as he dissects the greatest minds in strength, conditioning, and more. So whether your goal is to be the hammer, destroy mediocrity, or simply move the dirt, you've come to the right place. Now with the warm-up done, let the gains begin.
I am fascinated on COVID. I mean, I had to live through it, and I saw the hysteria. And what's interesting for me is I don't really fear a lot of things. And I really wasn't too scared about something like this because, and I know this sounds terrible, but—
And you shouldn't have been.
In Los Angeles, there's a lot of homeless people.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Southern California. There's a ton of homeless population. None of those people were dying. So what it tells me is the day that I see homeless in California start keeling over and dying and melting and all this, like, you know, stuff happening to them, those people were fine. They were living their best lives, and all of a sudden people are hiding indoors with masks. And I'm like, when it starts killing these people, I'm going to get nervous. Until that point, I'm not getting nervous.
I've had COVID twice. I took my ivermectin. I was better in 24 to 48 hours.
So what was the big push for the vaccine? Was it an idea of offering people freedom or?
Well, the first thing is, it came out of the blue. There was never any evidence that the COVID vaccine was any better than the traditional antigen vaccines they've been using for flu for 80 years. And so out of the blue came an experimental vaccine that ended up being given to over half the world's population. No one knew how it would work, whether it would work, or how dangerous it might be. And so it was a ball of surprises, and it was pushed obviously by the big pharma companies. There's the political linkage with it because, influence. And the bottom line is a lot of people made a lot of money out of it.
Yeah.
A lot of people died from it. And for a period of time, it was protective. But when you actually did cost-benefit analysis, even in that time, when it first came out, when we had essentially a population that was COVID naive, they hadn't got used to it, so their own immunity hadn't been built up. For that period of time, they were getting quite good protection against serious disease, hospitalization, deaths. But at the same time, when people did analyses of cost benefit, more people were getting serious problems from the vaccine than were actually being protected. And the second thing that happened is the people who are interested in this vaccine picked up only the clinical benefit side of the equation and then moved it on for the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, by which time the population had caught up with its own natural immunity. The vaccine virus and the virus in the community were getting further and further apart, so that by the time we got to 2024, with what was called the XBB variant at the time. Studies in the Cleveland Clinic initially, very good group of people, did some fantastic work, suddenly found that the people getting vaccinated were getting more infections. It's all published. This is not...
Well, no, I, Dr. Clancy, can you give everybody just a little bit of background on who you are and more importantly, why we're talking about this? Because I always feel like, especially in like this whole COVID landscape, it was always came down to like, trust the science, the experts have to talk. You know, there was a lot of kind of screaming and yelling, but you are an expert and you are an authority on this.
Well, yes, I am. It's what I do.
Yeah.
It's what I do. Sadly, it's not what a lot of the decision makers do, because they made some surprising, very surprising decisions. Look, my background is I'm a physician. I graduated in medicine. I became interested in clinical immunology, which is what I am, although at the time it didn't exist. It still doesn't exist in many parts of the world, including America, because you've got such good, strong vertical areas in allergy and rheumatology, etc. So it really developed in Canada, Australia, England. And I was one of the three that developed it in Australia because it was coming, it was needed. It's one of those funny cross-sectional sort of areas of medicine where you really become a specialist in a mechanism of disease rather than a particular organ system. My career has been very much in academia. I had the foundation chair of pathology in a medical school just north of Sydney, which was the world's second problem-based learning medical school after McMaster, where I'd actually worked and got my interest in mucosal immunology. So in brief, that's what I am.
So when so COVID hits, right? Like, I mean, early on, there was a lot of dispute about where this, you know, virus happened. Did it happen in a wet market in Wuhan? You know, how did it come? But, you know, I think we're pretty well now briefed on, we know exactly where it came from. It came from, you know, the Wuhan COVID research fund.
Yeah, or I think that's been known for a long time.
But I felt like there was a lot of pushback. So, I mean, it gets leaked out into the world, and probably that first iteration, that first like raw piece of virus was probably pretty destructive.
It was very nasty. It's a very good point that you're making, because in our country, which had obsessive lockdowns, it delayed the exposure. And we're being an island nation. I'm actually from Australia.
Yeah. If you guys couldn't have picked up, he is from Australia.
I don't have an accent, of course.
No, not at all.
You guys have accents. our border control was pretty good. And so by the time we started getting a lot of COVID, the vaccine program that had been initiated at the end of 2020 and early 21. And we were exposed to a milder form of COVID. And subsequently, our outcome was pretty good. And you're quite right. The disease is a relatively mild disease in people certainly under 65. And that was demonstrated very clearly in Southern California very early, by March 2020. The Stanford group went out and found that it had been, even by then, it had been 2 to 3% of the population had it, but 40% had never had symptoms. And the people who got sick are the older people, and they projected the mortality and the frequency from that figure, and that became an idea. It was called the Great Barrington Declaration, which you may have heard of, which was put together by three of the most senior epidemiologists in the world, one from Stanford, one from Harvard, and one from Oxford. And so, which is the way we should have handled it. We should have listened to the real epidemiologists, learnt from their experience, and we would have had a far better outcome than we had. Protect the people at risk. You must protect them, but let the rest get on with their lives.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also children were not at risk.
Oh,
look, so the idea of you know, shutting down schools and stopping children from moving through.
Look, if I say this, someone will say I'm wrong, but my understanding is not one healthy child died from COVID. I'm talking about kids under 12 in America or in the United Kingdom. Yeah. Not one.
No, all the children that ended up passing away were, you know, had other cause mortality, kids, leukemia and other terrible
kids
things.
Kids with risk factors.
Yes.
Exactly. And you know, the idea of immunizing in a blanket form children never had a basis of reality. If you go back to those early days, the argument was, well, the kids will take it home to grandma. It'll tr- the, that you'll prevent the transmission. Well, anyone who understood mucosal immunology and followed the flu vaccine story for 80 years would have known right at the beginning, it was not a secret, that you do not prevent transmission of disease, which is a respiratory airway virus infection, by injecting a vaccine that stimulates immunity, that puts up a barrier to stop the virus getting into the bloodstream, but has nothing to do with you getting infected or passing it on to grandma. So it was always misinformation. Does that surprise you?
No, it doesn't, because like I said, I mean, I realized that the first iteration, or like the first variant of this, was probably pretty nasty. And then over the course, and I remember it spread, and I remember there was like a huge mortality rate, like I want to say somewhere in Italy. Like, and I think it was like maybe some Chinese tourists or something, and there was, you know, bodies in the street. And so that initial kind of like hit of COVID that happened was coming to the US, and that was a lot of the reports we were getting. And then there was this idea.
Yeah, it was pretty scary ideas.
Yeah. And but, you know, for, you know, I always imagine kids go to school and trade coronaviruses all day. I mean, it's why kids are, you know, like that's why kids go to school, especially when school gets back. They end up getting some nasty stuff like we were talking about. I got that fifth disease from my kids and I never get sick. So, I mean, the fact that they were able to come back and bomb me with something,
right,
was, you know, pretty like just pretty telling. But like kids, you know, I don't need to tell you, but like the strongest immune system are the youngest people. I mean, age is a great determining factor for strength in the immune system.
Right.
So to basically force these kids home and then not cause interaction for kids who were not at risk felt very reactive and almost borderlining on reckless and stupid.
We interrupt this episode with a shameless self-promotion. Are you a field or court sport athlete looking to dominate the leaderboard? Let me introduce you to FieldStrong. Take your inner athlete to the next level by exposing yourself to the advanced training techniques that contributed to my 10 years in the NFL. Unlock pinnacle performance and level up your athletic potential today. Head to powerathletehq.com/FieldStrong and claim your 7-day free trial. This episode of Power Athlete Radio is powered by Train Heroic, the most immersive strength training app experience on the market. We've built an online training business by partnering with Train Heroic to deliver all of our world-class training programs like Jack Street, Hammer, Field Strong, and Grindstone. To learn which Power Athlete training program best suits your goals, head to powerathletehq.com/training. And if you're a coach looking to build a business with the best training tech in the business, head to trainheroic.com/powerathletehq. And now back to the show.
That's right. I mean, 65 is a watershed period. At 65, the immune system starts going to sleep. Even in healthy people.
Why is that?
Well, very good question. It's, I can call it immune senescence and give it a name to confuse you. But
are they senescent cells?
Yeah. It's part of a senescent aging process. It's partly that the progenitor cells, the early cells, are sort of disappearing. They've got a lifespan. They don't regenerate so effectively. So you have less reactive protective cells. Whole range of things that go with getting a little older. Unfortunately, it's a long way ahead of you.
Yeah.
I'm getting to know it.
Yeah. Hopefully you figure all this out before I get to be 65.
Yeah.
One of the things I was fascinated with your work was that you worked with the Australian Olympic team.
I did.
And we talked a little bit about not only the microbiome, but also Epstein-Barr and how some of those factors were playing into athletic performance.
Yeah. Well, it's a long story, but to cut it extremely short.
I love long stories.
Do you?
Yeah, this podcast is built on long stories.
I did a lot of teaching of medical students and doctors in Australia, and I was invited down to Canberra, where Australia has its Institute of Sport, because a very bright young rheumatologist was not getting through his exams because he was failing the immunology bit, as were everyone else. And so he said, look, come down, we'll pay you airfare, give you a decent meal, but give us a couple of days teaching. So I went down, we became friends. And later he ended up becoming the director of the Institute of Sport. Now, most of the swimmers in Australia go through and become part of the Institute of Sport. It's a very, very good organisation. And they had one guy who had been number one or two in the world in butterfly. And suddenly he was number 10 to 15. And when they did some investigations on him, they found that his immune system had actually dropped. And it was very confusing. So because I had the linkage and I knew the guys there, they said, look, could I come down and see this chap? Now, at the same time, an American group had found that people running marathons were getting quite sick and fatigued and dropping their mucosal immune system, that same immune system that's protecting you against COVID. And they were dropping their immunity and getting infections and getting sick, and they didn't understand why. And I just read this literally a month before. So I set up a program with the Institute of Sport, which actually went on for 5 or 6 years. I'll give credit entirely to my once PhD student, Professor Marie Gleason, who religiously followed this project right through. And it was very important, very exciting, because what we did is we followed the swimmers that were coming in for the training before an important meet. And we didn't want to take blood from them, and we're mucosal immunologists, so we took saliva just out of their mouth. And we found that some of these athletes had quite low levels of the antibody, which is specifically found in secretions, called IgA. And the IgA antibody was low. So we followed these guys and girls, and we found that the ones who get what's called overtraining syndrome, this is a performance impairment, were actually getting a form of very mild transient form of chronic fatigue syndrome. And they were getting quite sick. All they had to do is drop their time by a fraction of a second and put them out of the finals. And that, of course, was devastating for a young professional athlete, as you would well know. We then started looking at two things. We looked at why is this happening, and we looked at what can we do about it. And the why was that genetically, these people were linked to chronic fatigue syndrome, which occurs in 1% of the population. But they weren't, no one ever is going to call someone who's coming, you know, the second fastest swimmer in the world, as some of them they were, chronic fatigue syndrome. But they were at risk of decompensating and going through that period. And so what we did is we looked at their training program. And as you well know, the athletes talk about their training in terms of training volume. And the volume essentially in simple terms is the intensity by the duration. And we found it was the intensity of the training that actually most predisposed these people to the overtraining syndrome. And if we kept the volume the same by extending the period but reducing the intensity, the IgA level, when we were monitoring, there was one guy who had won the, it was the 96 Olympics. He won the kayaking, not the rough white water kayaking, the racing kayak. He was the world champion, a terrific guy. And he was also the local TV announcer.
Nice.
And so he could afford to pay my fare up to come up to Brisbane. Nice. So what we did, we put a program together where we actually worked with his physiologist and we monitored weekly his levels of IgA, and we tailored his training. And this guy never thought he'd get back into the 2000 Olympics, because it's the time we were doing this 20 years ago. And not only did he got back in. He won the Australian again because we were able to modulate his training so he didn't get impaired effect. So the way in which we managed it was by working with the trainers and working with the coaches and changing the pattern of coaching. And in the 2000 Olympics, where our swimmers did extremely well, every swimmer swam to their predicted best, which was unheard of, every one of them. Now, prior to that, in the 2 years before, in the Commonwealth Games, which Australia, England, and all the lesser countries participate in, we actually looked at what was happening. We found that when they drop their immunity with overtraining, it allows the Epstein-Barr virus, which is contained within the cell by T lymphocytes. These are immune cells which operate directly to shore up the protection capacity of the infected cell in the throat. So it doesn't become a problem. Now, if you drop that, then the virus can get out and cause a mini, you call it infectious mono over here, I think. They don't actually get fevers, and they might get a bit of a sore throat, but from their point of view, their performance gets impaired.
Sure.
And so what we did in the this is before we really had got the training programs right. We actually treated, it was all went through ethics committees with a very powerful anti-Epstein-Barr virus, and we prevented the emergence of the Epstein-Barr virus by pre-treating them before the actual performance in the game.
So was that like an antiviral?
Yeah, it's an antiviral, valcyclovir. It's a basically a very powerful form of the standard one you use for herpes on your lips or elsewhere.
Well, isn't Epstein-Barr tied to the monovirus as well, to mononucleosis?
Yeah, it's the cause. The cause. It's a herpes group virus. So it's very similar to herpes 1, which you get lip herpes 2 with vaginal herpes. They're all part of a group. And the acyclovir, which is the basic drug, is primarily used for herpes 1, 2 virus infections. And many of your followers would know about that. We used a high dose. I didn't say a word.
No, I just think it's I think it's funny. So I get my blood work done every 6 months.
Right.
And the one interesting thing is whenever I get it, I have, I think there's been years where I've had no herpes virus.
Right.
And then like occasionally, I think periodically every so often, yeah, I'll get like the herpes 1 will actually pop up, but never the herpes 2. And so I'm always like, I accuse my wife. I'm always like, if I get this, I know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And she's like, I don't have it either. And so it's become like a funny joke with us.
Yeah.
But
it's the same group of viruses, same type of treatment, but using it's the Epstein-Barr virus is not quite as susceptible. So we had to use a much higher.
But I mean, it's always in the body. It's just whether or not like the level at which it's at is based upon.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So the reason I ask was during my time in the NFL, I would get my blood tested. I would always get my blood work done before the season and then right after the season. And at the end of every season, my Epstein-Barr was through the roof.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was always very high. So I would
you weren't getting fatigue episodes.
Oh, I mean by the end of the season after you've been playing football for seven months, I was just fatigued and tired and
like everyone else.
And so then when I would leave, I'd always go and I'd do like high dose vitamin C and try to do and rest. Right. And then of course it was always very, very like very small before the season started. I always asked the doctor, I'm like, what do you think? And he thought it was actually coming into contact with other, you know, obviously close proximity.
No. You've had it probably from the age of 10. Mm. And it sits there. And just when you, I mean, as I said, we've worked on this with mental and physical stress. With the swimmers and the athletes, it was physical stress. We work with Antarctic winterers who have the same sort of problem. And there we found it was the mental stress. And we quantitated that using an interaction with Cape Canaveral, who have similar problems in space to Antarctica, believe it or not.
Is this something that everybody has?
90%.
So 90% of
100% of athletes.
100% of athletes.
Yeah, I think they get kissed at 10.
but you've encountered people that do not have Barr-FC.
I don't have it.
Oh, so you don't have it. Oh, that's interesting.
I haven't ever been kissed.
Oh, interesting.
I hope my wife's not watching this.
Well, so as you like it, I mean, obviously it kind of sits dormant, right? And then it's like, you know,
contained. It binds into the DNA. It's a DNA virus. So it binds with the DNA and it's integrated, but it's maintained there by these sentinel T cells around it that are sensitized. So if you strip them away, you're taking away the protection, and they, instead of just sitting in the DNA, they make the virus, and the virus gets released in small enough to impair your activity, you know, your
athletic performance. Yeah. So how does the microbiome, I mean, obviously.
Well, let's get back to the microbiome. Well, the microbiome, probably my take on the microbiome, and as you well know, I'm here the courtesy of your leading microbiome person, who is an amazing, amazing person, is really taking the microbiome idea clinically to another level. That's Dr. Hazan.
Yep.
And
who was on Power Athlete Radio, episode 803.
Well, your people wouldn't. It's just been an amazing week that I've had.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Hazan and her research and her information, I don't know, like, and this is true of many people that have a very significant impact. the impact of what they're doing will probably not be understood until many years past. Like her stuff is so cutting edge. And when I talk to people about it, they almost gloss over.
That's not the Dr. Hazan that I've come to know in the last week. She will make sure. No, what she's done is she's taking it to a different level. I mean, yeah. I followed the microbiome. My own interest is preventing that, improving resilience from an immunological point of view by maximizing the protection against abnormal microbiomes. What Dr. Hazan does is that she reinforces and changes the balance of the components of the microbiome. I was just blown away by the data. I think what a lot of people won't realize, and maybe you don't, that most ideas and development have traditionally come through universities. Universities aren't quite what they used to be. I mean, I've spent my life working in universities, and I no longer, well, for a variety of reasons, but I left the day I turned 60 because it wasn't the universities that I began. This is probably going to cost me an emeritus professorship, but and I love universities. But what's happened? People like as Dr. Hazan, they're in private practice.
Yeah.
They're doing not, you know, instead of just doing making sick people better and stopping well people getting sick, she's actually doing the basic research. Yeah. She's using the data she's getting, and I've just been going through it with her this week, and what she's talking about is a gap between the good and the bad of the bacteria and changing that balance. And so many conditions now are having dysbiosis or disturbance of that microbiome. Now, my interest has been up in the airways, and we've approached it a slightly different way. But her approach, which is perfect for the gut, is to change the desirability of living there by the bifida bacteria, which are the good bacteria.
Sure.
And my take on this, and maybe a bit different to hers, is that the microbiomes become so important in so many different conditions because it sort of acts as a buffer zone. If you've got a process that could lead to a particular disease, it can be suppressed by controlling the microbiome in a variety of ways, by the bacteria, by the products they make. And now she's looking at conditions like Parkinson's disease, autism. She's getting amazing results in autism. Now, we've known that for a while that by changing the bacteria can improve autistic disease. My daughter is a speech pathologist who's had a major interest in autism for 20 years. So I've been kept up to date, not because I see autistic kids. It's not in my area.
Well, you were saying that your grandson does jiu-jitsu.
Well, that's right.
Well, this is kind of interesting.
He's six. He's been doing it for 2 years.
So my son has been doing does jits as well. And jiu-jitsu has become like a bastion for a lot of these kids.
Yeah, he loves it.
Yeah, but a lot of the kids that come to jiu-jitsu, because I train, you know, Victor and some of the jiu-jitsu guys, they own a school.
Yeah.
And a lot of the kids that come in are on the spectrum, and they actually take to jiu-jitsu.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and so
Arash, part of like a therapy.
Well, it is. I mean, it's
a lifestyle.
Well, it's movement based.
Yeah,
and right. You know, and then it's also like athletic problem solving. So yeah. There's a lot of puzzle piece. But the other interesting one, and this is what Dr. Hazan had talked about, is that people that are deficient in certain things within the microbiome are attracted to certain people that have what they need. And she's like, maybe there's a situation where the instructors who tend to be from Brazil and other places are healthier. And so maybe the kids come and it's like more of a more comforting thing. I mean, the podcast and the conversations I've had with her completely changed my entire perception of not only immune function, but also the microbiome, our surroundings, the people we're around.
Yeah.
I didn't realize, I always pictured, the small intestine in the gut really being the window to the immune system, right? If it's healthy, you have a healthy immune system.
Well, but that's true.
Yeah. I looked at it almost very simplistically as the foods that you eat or the things that you put, you know, down the digestive tract, let's say, you know, start in the mouth and digestion goes down. So it wasn't until I interacted with her when she was talking about like soil microbes that when they went down and did the Doctors Beyond Borders down in down in Brazil in the Amazon, they were taking soil samples and they were finding the microbes in the soil that were in the same gut. And then she talked about being in Africa. There was an elephant, you know, big thing of dung.
Yeah, she was telling me about that.
Yeah, with the packed with ticks.
That's right.
So she thought everybody was going to have a bunch of like tick-borne illnesses, and they were going to have all these different issues. And then when she took samples from the caretakers and the guys who were their guides, not a single one of them had Lyme disease.
That's right.
And so she started kind of like realizing that, like, you know, there's this kind of interaction. So the interactions I'm having with her and, you know, working with my son, and I also wanted to talk a little bit of type 1 diabetes, since we were talking about that earlier, especially the fact that they're doing some isolate transplants. But like understanding the dynamic nature of this microbiome and realizing we were talking about Dr. Phil Yu, who's been on the podcast. When Dr. Yu got his gut done, she pulled up mine in parallel. And one of the interesting things was there's a microbe associated with high protein consumption because they ate a lot of steaks and meat. And so does Dr. Phil. So that number was pretty high. But then when we went and looked at the parasites, his parasites were like 30%, whichever in her deal. Mine were like 0.003. And she's like, his gut, even though he's eating, you guys are eating the same amount of meat, he's eating obviously from a lesser quality or eating more takeout or different things. His parasites, that's why he's sick. She's like, that's why you're not exhibiting any issues, because you don't have the parasites. So understanding like the dynamic nature, that it's just not the foods you eat, but it's also, you know, the sources that you're getting it from. How often do you cook at home? Like understanding the entire spectrum of this has been really enlightening for me.
Yeah. You mentioned the environmental factors, food, et cetera. It all began in 1978. And before 1978, people looked, without the technology we have today, at the microbiome, and people looked at the immune system on the other side of the mucosa. In 78, an Englishman began an idea that if you live, well, he looked at large families and found that larger the family, the less they were getting allergies. And he came up with the idea of exposure to dirt and bacteria and pathogens was a good thing, because it stimulated your immunity and you didn't get allergic disease. And then that moved into Europe when they found that people, for example, living on farms had much less asthma, much less allergy. And of course, farms in Europe, they bring the animals in the house. It gets pretty cold. I'm sure it never happened in the United States. So the animals, there's a part of the...
I'm totally fine with it. You came to the house, you saw, like, I have my dog who...
Oh, he's a good dog.
Yeah, he's a great dog. I've been so fortunate to have the best collection of dogs. Right. We just lost one pretty recently.
Oh, sad.
Yeah, he was 13. He had lymphoma for 4 years, lived a great life, so he passed on. So his sidekick, who you met, Vinny, is... So attention starved, like he saw somebody, he was like ready to bolt out the door.
That's right. I was beaten to death by sand shoes. But what the Europeans particularly found was that when they looked at the stools, it was full of bugs like Bifida or similar types of good bugs. It wasn't nearly as sophisticated as Dr. Hazan can do now with the technology she has. And this developed this whole idea of allergy being in privileged societies where there's no germs, kids don't get on the, as though they're missing out on pathogens. But the whole thing's turned around now as we've known more about the microbiome. And in fact, it's the good bacteria that are promoting turning off the mechanisms of allergy, right? So the good, it's not the bad ones stimulating no allergy, it's the good bacteria like Bifida that are actually mediating protection. And all this is now well understood in terms of molecular and bacterial, very exciting sort of stuff. So they've all come together really only in the last 30, 40 years.
So in a big part of, I think the interesting thing for you, especially with COVID hitting Australia and then also Australia being pretty draconian in how they approached it. I mean, they locked people down. They were throwing people in jail. I mean, just their...
They did. Doctors included.
Yeah. I mean, but how come that result... Like, here in the U.S., we have a certain, I don't know, maybe cowboy spirit, let's say, where there's a lot of like kind of... I don't know. I like to believe that there was a cowboy spirit. Like, there was a lot of kind of like rebellious type people. But I was actually... pretty disgusted with a lot of the way that people acted in COVID.
We're a bit more like sheep herders.
Well, yeah, but so that was hard for me because I always picture Australia. I mean, it was populated by a bunch of convicts, you know, like they load up the boats in England and say,
they're still, there.
Yeah. But I kind of imagined.
They wear ties and suits now.
I imagined if that's your lineage, if you were a bunch of criminals that got shipped down to this island, and I've been to Australia, I always. So anytime I travel the world.
You'd be liked in Australia.
I had a great time in Australia.
Australian personality, yeah.
Well, when we went down there, we taught a ton of seminars. Always had a great time. They like to barbecue, like to drink some beers. They like going to the beach. You know, 23 million people all living around the coast, which is roughly the size of California.
Right.
And we went to Perth. It felt like what I imagined California looked like in the 60s.
Right.
So it's been one of those places, like same with New Zealand. Like when I travel to New Zealand, Australia, I've always, and I don't know if you do this, but wherever I travel to, I always think, take that moment, like, could I live here? Like, is this a place that I would enjoy
it's
living?
It's a natural thing to do.
Australia and New Zealand are two places that I would have no problem living in.
A lot of Americans are coming out to Australia, which is terrific. We really like that. Well, I think you mentioned COVID. COVID, my interest in COVID became, why is it that you get 100 people and 95 of those will get a sniffle, they'll get a little bit sick for a few days. Five of them will get very sick. One of them, or two of them might go to hospital and one might even die. Not a lot, but so you've got, you look at these people, they look exactly the same. And so it seemed to us that this was an issue of resilience. Why is the mucosal immune system protective in some, but not in others? And we'd been looking at this for quite some time. And we found that one in four people, the way the lung protects itself is not having your immune cells sitting there waiting for the virus. We swallow a cup full of secretions while we're sitting here. We're swallowing secretions with all the bugs in it going to the gut. And there's factories in the wall of the small bowel, little nodule factories. And so these factories have got mouths on them and they take up these bugs and they make specific T lymphocytes. Now, T lymphocytes are protective immune cells. They have stamps on them that say, get in the bloodstream and take me back to the lungs. And so you've got this incredible circuit where these cells come back and they impose and give the lungs their protection because the lungs only have one job, one real job, putting oxygen into the body, taking carbon dioxide out. They don't want to be bored with having to have factories of making immune cells. And so they deliver this system. And so we made that system work really efficiently. And we were able to completely stop people getting, you know, if you get a cold or some people get a cold, it goes to their chest, they get a bit of cough and sputum. We stopped that by making these people far more effective and efficient by simply feeding the killed bacteria that they're not getting enough of. So in a sense, it links with Dr. Hazan's ideas of controlling the microbiome because it's all going down into the gut. So there's a connection as a single sort of system. So we developed this very simple way and we found that if we took people with bad disease, like chronic lung disease, emphysema, we kept these people, for the first time, we could keep people out of hospital. Now, your people listening to this won't know about it. This is really cutting edge sort of stuff that very simply is like taking a vitamin, but instead a kill bacteria. By making their system of defense work more efficiently, they did not, when they got a virus, instead of getting an exacerbation that put them into hospital, half of these people with cough and sputum and with chronic lung disease were not going into hospital, which no other treatment can do for them. So we believe, I believe anyway, that the way to go with not only the mucosa in the lung but the gut is to work, and this is why Dr. Hazan and I are working together this week, that we're bringing together two components that the outcome of the interaction determines the outcome of infections that come that way. So I'm teaching her about the immunology. She's teaching me an awful lot about the microbiome. We all both knew a little bit about the other side, but we have a huge respect now for the other people's thoughts and views.
So earlier in the discussion, you talked about COVID being a respiratory virus. And that the thought that by injecting a vaccine in the bloodstream, that it was going to protect you from a, like something in the lungs that's just like airborne vaccine or sorry, virus,
yep.
Didn't make a lot of sense.
Makes no sense. And we knew this. We should have known this before the COVID even came, that an injected vaccine will put a wall of antibody around the lungs, but they won't get into the lungs. In other words, you can still get infected and pass it on and transmit it. So all the ideas of lockdown were not based on any fact. They were based on who knows.
Well, and then also the myth that was propagated over and over again, that if you get the vaccine and you get COVID, you will not continue to spread it and it'll stop, the transmission will stop.
That's wrong.
Yeah, we heard that over and over again.
And it was, and the tragedy is that people who, I don't know where they got it from. They should have known that it was extremely unlikely that a significant impact would be, and the evidence finally came out. But we had the evidence from flu.
Yeah.
So we knew this. And the other thing, vaccine mandates were based on the same concept, that we'll vaccinate the kids so they won't take the virus home to grandma. And of course, it was never going to have any effect on the kids getting infected or passing it on.
Want to lose up to 15% of your body weight? Fridays helps you achieve lasting weight loss. We combine GLP-1 medication with nutritional coaching, mental health support, and fitness plans tailored just for you, all included in one monthly price. At Fridays, one price, every month, all doses, and everything is included. Getting started is simple. Take our quiz and get connected with a provider to start your journey. Fridays is certified by LegitScript, so you know the medications are produced safely by accredited pharmacies. Check us out on Trustpilot with over 1,000 five-star reviews. Don't wait. Save $100 off any plan when you start your weight loss journey today. Visit joinfridays.com and use code Fridays100. That's joinfridays.com, code Fridays100. Joinfridays.com, code Fridays100. Medications will only be prescribed by a licensed clinician if deemed medically appropriate after a thorough consultation. Results are not guaranteed and may vary by individual. Compounded products are not FDA approved or evaluated by the FDA for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Please visit our website for important drug safety information. Want to lose up to 15% of your body weight? Fridays helps you achieve lasting weight loss. We combine GLP-1 medication with nutritional coaching, mental health support, and fitness plans tailored just for you, all included in one monthly price. At Fridays, one price, every month, all doses, and everything is included. Getting started is simple. Take our quiz and get connected with a provider to start your journey. Fridays is certified by LegitScript, so you know the medications are produced safely by accredited pharmacies. Check us out on Trustpilot with over 1,000 five-star reviews. Don't wait. Save $100 off any plan when you start your weight loss journey today. Visit joinfridays.com and use code Fridays100. That's joinfridays.com, code Fridays100. Joinfridays.com, code Fridays100. Medications will only be prescribed by a licensed clinician if deemed medically appropriate after a thorough consultation. Results are not guaranteed and may vary by individual. Compounded products are not FDA approved or evaluated by the FDA for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Please visit our website for important drug safety information.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from United Healthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a United Healthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about United Healthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
And so the whole vaccination of kids, to me, as a mucosal immunologist with many years' experience, made no sense.
Wow.
Does it make sense to you?
No, it didn't make any sense to me either.
And kids were dying from it. Well, you know?
And all the smart doctors I know, like Doc Parsley and all the guys, were like, this doesn't make any sense. And I remember having Dr. Parsley, who's Doc was a former SEAL and then was a SEAL doc. And he's like, you know, I'm not a smart man, but actually I know this stuff because this is what I've done my entire life. And none of this makes sense.
Well, I'm saying the same. I'm not a smart man, but I've been doing it all my life.
Yeah.
And that's what I do.
So when COVID hit, like what should of the response have been? Should we have just like should it have been the flu where it should have just gone?
Stanford University guys got it right in March of 2020. They went out to a small town in California and they took blood to see how many were infected. They found, they were terribly surprised. This is, you know, in March of 2020, when COVID was just coming, they found about 2 to 3% had already been infected. 40% of them were asymptomatic. They had no symptoms. They said, well, wait a second, this is a pretty mild infection. They worked out that that people who were getting sick were over 65. And so they came up, they put together with serious experts from your best universities and England's best universities with a plan. And it was called the Great Barrington Program or Declaration. And it said, look after the vulnerable, look after people over 65, people of any age who have got collateral disease, kids, young adults, old adults. But let the other people go to school, let them work. And at the same time, we had been looking at drugs like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, which were highly effective.
Well, why are those? I mean, I know ivermectin to be an anti-parasite drug.
Well, these are all bioproducts. They come from either microbes or plants. Chloroquine, of course, is from quinine, and that comes from the quinine cinchona bark. The ivermectin is a derivative from a particular bacteria in Japan on a Japanese golf course. It has to be a Japanese golf course. And it's a very cheap drug to make.
Yeah.
Highly effective. It got a Nobel Prize.
For curing river blindness.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah. But what it does, they don't work on the virus. They work on the cell, both these drugs, to make the cells less able to act as a factory for the virus to take over to make more virus, because that's what viruses do. They come in, put in their genetic information, take over the machinery of the cell and make millions of copies. And what the ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine do, they prevent that to a large extent happening. Now, studies came out very quickly showing these were effective, but it didn't fit the narrative that fitted with the vaccine, because the vaccine, to actually get regulation approval, it had to show that there was nothing else that could be effective.
Oh, yeah, this was to get the emergency.
The emergency thing. Yeah. It happened in your country, I think, certainly happened in mine. And so there was huge effort to shut down things that could have saved many, many, certainly in my country. I can't talk about America. Saved many lives. My view is that many people died, because this should have been in every nursing home. It's so safe, so cheap, and so effective.
So when COVID ends up rocking the world and coming down, and were you one of the first people that they reached out to?
No. In Australia, there was only one immunologist on any of the committees, and he was basically a mouse immunologist. He certainly didn't understand mucosal immunology. And that was the problem, that we had all the experts, you probably had them on TV too, saying, you must do this, you must do that. And they didn't quite know what they were talking about.
So that seems, because what we used to hear over and over again, especially on the TV, especially from like the Rachel Maddows and these fucking absolutely like the worst people on the planet, there was this constant state of trust the experts, trust the science. Yeah, trust the science.
Well, I'm trying to scratch my head saying, this is not the science
funny,
I know.
Because the minute that I hear that, all of a sudden, like every hair on my body stands up and I get like my spider sense.
Don't trust the science.
Yeah, I don't trust it. Yeah. And especially people that keep saying trust the science. It's like, one of my favorite things on the internet where people ask you, have you done your research? And I'm like, watching YouTube videos is not research. And most of you don't have the ability to actually read and understand any of the peer-reviewed literature.
They trust people that they wanted to put trust in to make the right decisions. And those people never explained what was going on. They never explained. They presented the genetic vaccines as some magical thing that had come from nowhere that was going to be better. It was going to be the magic bullet to save you from COVID. Well, of course, it wasn't the magic bullet. In fact, it's almost certainly killed more people than it saved. It did. There was a period of time when people were COVID naive, when the vaccine first came out, that there was some, none of them were randomized controlled trials on my ad.
They had their the emergency exemption, and we had Operation Warp Speed. We had to get the vaccine in people's hands to save lives.
Yeah, the only randomized controlled trial was against very mild disease, which had nothing to do with people getting very sick. So when they started looking at the sick people, they were all what they call observational studies with many imperfections. And there was a period where they were getting good protection against serious disease. But very quickly, three things happened. The people started getting natural immunity. The virus was changing in the community. And the virus in the vaccine was getting further and further behind. And so if you look at the most recent studies, fantastic studies done at the Cleveland Clinic in America and in Quebec, where they've actually followed not for the 2 months where you get a little bit of protection, but for the full vaccine cycle. But after 3 months, there are more people getting negative immunity with more infections, more serious infections, not more, but 80% of the time, you've got a better chance of getting serious infections than not getting serious infections from the current vaccine.
Why is that?
It's because everyone listening to this will know if they go to an allergist to stop them getting too much immune response to inhaled grass pollens, they'll get a shot of injections. The vaccines for COVID were just like those shots against, because the body can't tell a difference in a virus and a pollen. And so just as the body's geared to make suppression of responsiveness to too many things being inhaled in, the virus is going to have the same impact as a pollen. So you're basically having allergy shots. And so you're turning off the immunity rather than initially you turn it on and then you turn it off. So after three vaccines, I see people having their seventh and eighth vaccine.
Oh, you mean that are getting the boosters?
Yeah, there's five or six boosters. I say, please, you know, slow down. Because no one's ever done this before except the allergists when they want to turn off the immune response. Does that make sense? Or
Yeah. No, so the interesting thing is when they looked at the numbers of COVID deaths and kind of how it played out, it mirrored very closely with what we see within flu season.
Yeah.
So, but the interesting thing with flu season is everybody that I know that gets a flu shot usually ends up getting sick anyway.
That can't be.
Right.
Well, this is what's scary. I'll tell you what's scary. That same Cleveland Clinic, and I have enormous respect. I've been communicating with the guy who's been doing it. If you're listening, I hope we get a chance to meet sometime. He's done serial studies of COVID, and then he's just published one on the flu for the first time ever. There was 27% more flu infections in the vaccinated population than the population that wasn't. Now, this has created havoc amongst the vaccinologists. And believe me, I am not an anti-vaxxer. I'm an immunologist. I'm a great believer in vaccines where vaccines are needed and they work well. But I put it to him that because all these people had been getting COVID vaccination, they were getting sort of passive suppression of immunity against flu as well, which is well understood. And so the residual of having all the COVID vaccines is they weren't getting the expected protection from flu vaccines because the suppressor mechanism has been more powerful there than the positive protective mechanisms.
Is there
that's scary stuff.
Is there a change? Like as you're analyzing and looking at your patients, can you tell a remarkable difference between, you know, the mucosa and the immune system and that for those that have been vaccinated versus those that haven't?
Yes, if I immunologically look, because there are markers that we're starting to see, actually even in the blood, particular types of antibody subtypes are appearing, which you only see in people who have been desensitized with allergy shots. This funny antibody appears, which is like a marker of suppression. Net negative rather than positive protection.
Yeah. Is there any way to cleanse the body or purify? I mean, I'm just wondering, is there a way to counteract this, or is this just something that their body's going to have to evolve past?
Slow down on. I think the real answer is talk to your doctor about spacing your vaccines so that you're not going to be exposed to protection going the wrong way. Mm-hmm.
Is we brushed a little bit on Dr. Hazan's research on autism. As a parent, it's pretty interesting. I think, I was born in 1976. I think, when I looked at the numbers, it was one out of 100,000 kids had autism. I'd never even had heard of autism until I saw the movie Rain Man, with Tom Cruise.
Well, you're in good company. When I was an intern, we never saw autistic kids. Autism was something we knew about, but thought was so rare we didn't really have to know about it.
Yeah, so
it's what, 1 in 30 in America or something.
Yeah, I mean, so is it? Do those numbers pair and kind of pace with what's happening in Australia?
Absolutely. My daughter is a speech pathologist, and her primary interest for 20-30 years has been autism, and most of what I know about autism I've learned from Sarah. So
what changed in the last 50 years?
Well, my view on autism is it's a very complex interaction between genetics, not the genetics that we learned about of your single gene causing you to become an albino or something like that. It's a new type of analysis of genetics. It's called combinatorial. And what it means is you look at a particular gene, and it's not as though you've got abnormal genes, but you've got sets of genes interacting in a way that gives an abnormal outcome. So whatever that might be, my view is this anyway, so you become genetically predisposed. For example, it's well recognized in twins, in monozygotic twins. It doesn't have to be in the family, but it's a bit like sudden infant death syndrome, which I had quite a lot to do with many years ago, and where you see this sort of family history of near SIDS and things like that. And yet when you look at the genetics, you don't see a one gene sitting out or family members having necessarily. Once you've got that, various precipitants in the environment, it's clearly environment's become a big factor. And I think what's becoming very clear is the microbiome is very important in modulating these interactions in some way, ways in which we're beginning to understand. I see the Chinese now are identifying particular factors coming from bad microbiomes, and that may be affecting some minor change which is already existing. So you have a precipitating environmental factor, you've got the underpinning microbiome, you've got this vague genetics, which is different to the genetics we've understood in the past. And it's this sort of combination of things that come together. And it's got to be environmental, and it's got to be to do with the microbiome, because the dramatic changes in the last 50 years is not genetic.
Yeah. Wow. It's a complex problem. I mean, what do they call it? Like a neurodivergent issue, and it's a developmental issue. So like, is it something that's happening in vitro? Is it like, I mean, there's probably an infinite amount of variables that are happening.
Absolutely.
And I know when I talked to Dr. Hazan on her research, she had, you know, kids that were in her study that were, you know, vaccinated, unvaccinated, different places. I mean, so this is something.
There's going to be different factors.
Yeah. But what's fascinating is all of these different factors are coming through, but they're all manifesting in some neurodivergent way.
Yeah, and I think one of the interesting, you can't do much about genetics that's hard to understand anyway. It's not like a single gene causing a particular problem. And I think the way to go forward is to work towards a society that has a healthy microbiome. Bifida seems to be a really good hallmark, whether that's the mediator of health or whether it's just saying this, if you've got high levels of this, you've got a healthy microbiome. I think that's critical. I've been looking at some of the microbiomes of these kids of Dr. Hazan's. I mean, they have no bifida.
Yeah.
And she's got dramatic changes in some of these people where she's pushed the bifida up, and they're reading. There were kids of 7 and 8 who couldn't read, couldn't speak, couldn't communicate.
Yeah.
And 9 months later, they're reading. I mean, it's biblical.
She showed me the videos of the kids being nonverbal.
Yeah, yeah.
And then after her treatments, all of a sudden now they become verbal and they're speaking and they're able to interact and learn.
It's biblical. I think what we need to do is and a friend of mine has just been given the job as to head your Let's Make America Healthy Again.
Yeah, what is it? Maha.
Maha. And he's just become the head. He's an amazing guy. And I'm sure he's the sort of person that's going to look at these. He's very into protection again and health and maintenance of high-level health. So that's a huge factor, which is a national factor. The microbiome, I think, relates a lot to diet. and various and people like Dr. Zahner are really probing every week or two, coming up with different ways of trying to get better levels of the bifida and related organisms. Very exciting stuff.
Yeah. No, it's as a parent, you know, I have three kids, but it's pretty heartbreaking when you talk to these parents who have these kids that are dealing with it. And then, you know, and there's always this, like similar to what we were talking about, like with type 1 diabetes.
Well, yeah.
My son contracts it with no genetic history, and we went and did,
You're not going to find one big light.
Well, no, but I think that's what people are looking for. And then talking to like various parents with kids with type 1, I listened to one mom. It's like, oh, you know what? I gave him ice cream once a week. Or another mom who said, you know, I let my child swim in a pool with chlorine. That was the reason.
Yeah.
So there's always these like this guilt as a parent that you've done something that has allowed these, you know, disease.
But you've got to listen to these moms, because very often they'll come up with something that because there's no one factor that causes it. It's a complicated interaction. And maybe it was not enough lactobacilli in the ice cream the kid was eating.
So as I told the mom, I'm like, I don't think you can punish yourself with that.
Yeah. You can't.
Yeah, you can't. Like, I mean, you know,
it's no fault. No fault. Well,
there's kids that eat fast food for every single meal that are drinking, you know, 2-liter bottle of soda. I mean, like I've seen kids and I saw it in the NFL. I played with guys who ate, you know, nothing but McDonald's and chicken nuggets and drank sodas that were, you know, 3-4% body fat. And we're high performers. And like, you know, they were like, I don't know all this diet stuff. I'm fine. I'm like, you are succeeding in spite of what you're putting into
your
body.
And look at them in 20 years time.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting one too. I mean, you know, in their 20s are pretty fine, but now all of a sudden they get in their 40s and 50s now they're not all of a sudden able to do
twice
the same
the
thing
size,
they did.
Same height.
Yeah. And, you know, diabetes is a factor, and like all of a sudden all these all-cause mortality starts coming up. Obviously, that was another huge factor in the COVID deal, you know, like certain, like obesity, sickness, I mean, pre-existing conditions.
Yeah. And a lot of that's coming back to the microbiome. Interesting. Obesity has an abnormal microbiome.
That's what that's what we talked about. She said that, systemic effect and like the oxidative effect of increased fat and obesity as a major player in the microbiome.
Right. Absolutely. It's early days, and all of a sudden I will give her the credit, because she has taken what has been a blanket approach. The guy who started fecal microbiome transplants was a friend of mine, the guy, in fact, I do my clinic in his organization, a chap called Tom Barodi. Tom really put that on the map, but what Sabina's done is she's taken it from the crew just taking feces from a well person and putting it into an unwell. She now has analysed what the pattern of bacteria, and she's identified a pattern that correlates increasingly with good health. And so she can select the donors in a way that hasn't been done before. Now, in 10 years' time, we're going to be talking about something completely different. I'll give you my projection. And Dr. Zan and I have been talking about this. We're going to have little capsules which will have the very select bacteria you want. They'll be live bacteria. They'll be enteric coded. And maybe they'll be for people with early Parkinson's, some different thing. This is what's going to happen. And if you don't believe me, talk to someone my age and say, did you ever think we'd have a portable phone?
Yeah.
Mobile phone.
Yeah. No, I mean.
That was Dick Tracy country.
Last year, there was an event here in Austin from a doctor that we've had on the podcast, Adil Khan, who has now gone on to be the doctor for the Saudi royal family. And the conference was on longevity, and the guy got up and gave a talk, who was a geneticist, where he said, you know, genetically, if you look at our genes, we can make it to about 120 years old. After about 120,
of a ceiling.
Yeah, that's pretty much the ceiling. The biggest issue we run into is that we have to be able to combat all-cause mortality and run, you know, like to be able to get there. So people are, you know, dying from, you know, I want to say if you're a man in this or a man in the United States, you're probably going to die of one of two things. It's either going to be a heart attack or some form of cancer is going to kill like 98% of us. So their deal was like, you know, how do we beat all this all-cause mortality? How do we avoid cancer? How do this to be able to get people to 120? And as it got into this, I don't believe it's in the genes as much. And I think the research and the information that Dr. Hazan has been going through about the microbiome just makes complete sense that that is the level, like resilience and durability. Like, are you resilient enough to, like, when these things pop up, does the body just stomp them out? I mean, if you think about cancer, why is it that, you know, two identical people, two twins, one get cancer, one doesn't? You know, why, you know, why is it that, you know, somebody gets sick and my son gets type one and somebody else gets something else? Yeah. So it's pretty interesting. Like, I think all of these things are kind of present within the body, which comes to fruition, and what hits might be just based upon what happens within the microbiome.
I think you're really onto a very important point, because if you talk to most medics, most of my friends, they'll say, oh, we can now, we've got the whole DNA genome, we know everything about it, we can predict. Now, clearly, genetic factors are important, but it's the environment and food and various environmental factors. Not only are they interacting, they're actually conditioning that you can actually change the genetic type in individuals as a result of certain environmental factors. And I think that's where we're going to see huge changes in.
So we had a geneticist on the podcast from Amsterdam New Genomics, which does a genetic deal. And then they kind of, it's almost like an annuity that you, like, once you put your genetics in, I get research pushed to me almost every week on my specific, like, the genes that I have that they've assessed. One of the ones I have is for a amylase deficiency. Okay. That theoretically, based upon this gene, I should not be able to do any physical exercise without such severe body pain I can't move.
Tells you a lot, doesn't
it? And if I exercise too much, I'll get rhabdomyolysis.
Oh, wow.
So I 100% have this. It's like, you know, they show like this little circle and mine's like 90%.
I think there's a message there somewhere.
Well, and
for someone who's been very physically involved.
Yeah. And so when I got this done, I, you know, that was the first thing that popped up. I called him, and the guy who's a, you know, Harvard MIT, you know, professor, geneticist, he's like, ah, it's just one more day. We find out that the, you know, we don't know anything about the genetics, but more importantly, that it's probably a gene, but there's other genes on top of it that take higher order.
And I think that's what this new type of genetic analysis, where they're talking about how the genes talk to each other and come up with an outcome that is not predicted by a single gene abnormality.
Well, what I mean, we've seen changes in very, very many landscapes over the last 50 years, right? Like, so diets changed. You know, I remember the diet that, you know, we had when we were kids, and I remember seeing and going through and seeing this change within the food pyramid. I mean, you think about the environmental toxins, everything from, you know, glycophosphate to what they're burning in the environment with jet fuel. I mean, think about, like, the food source. You know, the food today is about 1/10 as nutrient dense as it was 50 years ago. That's another one. Dr. Tom Inkledon, who's been on this podcast, he does more blood testing than anybody I know on the planet. And it's like, you know, over the last 30 years, the amount of nutrient deficiency from people eating the same foods, just because the foods aren't as nutrient dense as they were. So you think environmental toxins, I mean, all of these key factors, feels like it's kind of a cascading effect, like an overload, that we're just seeing this down the road. It's not just one thing, but it's all of these things.
Oh, absolutely. And look at the complexity that it imposes. It's huge.
So what's the solution?
Well,
like, how do we make people healthier that want to live,
look,
you know?
I think the solution is, first, at several levels. There are a lot of things we already know. We have a pretty good idea about diet, exercise, simple things that the majority of people in the population are not paying attention to. And I think that's what Kennedy and others are going to try to get happening in this country. But what a massive turnaround. I mean, I went last night to a little diner-type arrangement for food. I couldn't believe it. There were kids stuffing themselves with most you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I thought, gee, they're doing the same in my country.
Yeah.
It's not, it's not Robinson Crusoe.
No.
So I don't know how you change. It's very hard to change people. But I think the mothers and the women are probably going to be the defining factors. I've been lucky. My wife is a superb cook. She understands nutrition. She was a pharmacist by training. And I haven't had a bad meal in 53 years. Not a bad meal. I don't know why we ever bother going out, but She would deny. I hope she never watches.
No, that's funny.
I'm in serious trouble.
Because my dad said the exact same thing.
Did he?
He raced home every night because my mom was a good cook.
If she hadn't have looked after me, I'm sure I wouldn't be alive today.
Well, my dad made a funny joke where he said, there's no husband ever divorces a bad cook. And my dad was, you know, like I said, he was a criminal defense attorney. Yeah. He did some family law and he had such a good sense of humor.
Right.
Like my dad would crack me up constantly, but he used to make that joke. He's like, in all my years, he goes, the only guys I know that ever got divorced, wife was a terrible cook. He's like, if more women figured out that men will stay, you know, be racing home every night. They're not going to hang out the bar. They're not going to do anything if their wife can cook. He's like, they probably all learn it a little bit better.
It's true.
It's true. My wife or my mom was pretty funny.
Probably the easy answer to your question is marry well.
Well, my mom, who's a good cook, I'm the youngest of three. So I was her sous chef. Like I was her assistant.
Right.
So I learned to cook. And my dad was a terrible cook.
You still cook?
Oh, yeah. Every night.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. I eat 99.9% of all of our food I make. Oh, right. We go out to dinner like maybe one night a week.
Yeah. We do the same.
Yeah. Just not be weird to go. And also with Austin, there's so many good places to eat that we kind of try to pick one and go to a different place and that way it happens. But I cook almost everything. I mean, I buy all my meat and everything from a rancher about an hour from here. Right. So everything's locally sourced.
Pretty good stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, we are very, very, like, I feel very blessed to live where we do in Austin and have access to what we do. You know, it's also great. I remember when, you know, obviously Dr. Hazan lives out in Malibu. So when she came out here, she's like, I can't believe you have all this land and there's all this dirt. And it was funny.
Well, it's Texas.
Yeah. It's Texas. Yeah. It's a
great state. Australia.
Very, very similar. When I went to Australia, one of the questions, actually, one of the guys that follows our training program, I can't remember where in Australia he lives, but he works in the outback.
Uh-huh.
And so he basically goes like 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and they do a bunch of mining and stuff. And I told him, I was like, you know, one of the places I've always wanted to visit is I want to drive through the Australian outback. And he's like, why? There's nothing out here. And I'm like, but every time you see any of the pictures, I mean, there's some just amazing stuff.
Oh, so. There's a lot out there, but it's not there. You know, it's
desolate.
It's wonderful, wonderful country.
Yeah. So going forward, I mean, like, I always think, like, you know, I always like everybody to take everything away.
What do I think? Where is it going?
Yeah.
Okay. I think, number one, the microbiome has to be a focus of broad attention. People like Dr. Hazan needs to have people get behind her, people who have the huge laboratory, expensive equipment, so that you can go the next jump. I think she's going to sort of come out with various therapies that will be good and then needs to work to take it further. So the microbiome has really got to be a focus. From my point of view, I think that we've got to think not just of vaccines, we've got to be very careful about how we think about what we want to vaccinate against. My view is that we move to a different way, and this is what I've been doing effectively, is to change the way the body responds to an infection. Now, the microbiome is an important part of that, but also, and that's in fact what we do, but we do it immunologically. We feed, we've learned how to make the airways more resilient by if you get an infection, instead of getting serious infection, you get an asymptomatic. We're shifting the response by making the mucosa of the airways more protective. And I think that we're doing it with a pretty simple thing by just using killed bacteria, which doesn't turn anybody on, but it works. You know, it halves hospitalization in emphysema. So they're two broad areas. What I'm doing now, in 20 years' time, people are going to have the big pharma companies will make it a patentable product. And that's what they do. We're not so concerned about the patents. We're concerned about health. So medically, I think they're the two broad areas we're going to see a lot of. And we'll see other things as well. I think that big issues are going to be community issues. How we try to educate communities into better lifestyle. Now, you're leading the way in terms of physical fitness, incredibly important. We all know the benefits to health. Others are looking at nutritional aspects. The issues of obesity are huge. I'm interested in the Aboriginal population in Australia. And to see these kids, they're they're going to school not able to hear because they've had lots of airways infections, because of just the environmental way they all live in close quarters. Bugs are there, they're sleeping on the floor, and they get ear infections, they can't hear, which is an area my daughter's very interested in helping with as a speech pathologist. I can help with that by improving the resilience of these kids' airways by very simply working out how to best control their microbiome, what they're swallowing, and we can do that. Obesity is a huge problem in our Aboriginal population, in our Caucasian populations, both here and in Australia. And this is education, isn't it? But I think the women are really where it's going to happen. The mothers, the grandmothers, because if you go to any society I've worked with, which is New Guinea, Australia, other Europe, North America, very often it's the cook, the mother who's she is aware of health and nutritional issues.
Well,
does that make sense? I mean,
no, it does. No, it makes complete sense. I mean, I've always thought that. So I have a few, like, not weird phobias, but one of the weird things, like, hoarders make me really uncomfortable. Like, you ever go in and somebody's just, you know, pack rat. But I'm always fascinated by those people that are, like, you know, 600, 700, 800 pounds. And, you know, they got to, like, cut open the house and they bring in a crane to get these people out. Most of them are bedridden and they can't walk. And so I always think that there's somebody who's there enabling them, right? Obviously, somebody's bringing them the food. Somebody's doing this. They're not moving
someone
themselves.
Someone didn't do the right thing a long time ago.
Well, yeah. But so every time you see one of those people, there's an enabler. And so I think the same thing with, you know, people that are unhealthy or obesity in this country, like especially with kids. I mean, those kids aren't doing the shopping. Like the mom's buying it. They're not doing a good job of monitoring it. I mean, it's like the same thing with my dog, right? Like if I overfeed him, he gets a little chunky. I put the food back and I take him on more walks. And then we make sure he's like at a target weight. And I don't know why that's a weird conversation.
The kids sit in front of TV and they're getting hit with these extraordinary ads for unbelievable rubbish.
Kids don't even watch TV anymore. This is the weirdest thing.
They play games.
Well, they have devices.
Yeah.
So they watch YouTube. They're in this streaming thing.
Oh, right.
So whereas, you know, we used to plop down, and I still do it just merely probably out of habit. Like I'll sit down and watch something. But I also come, you know, obviously I'm much younger than you, but like I come from a time when like we turned on the TV, there was a show, you watch the show, you turn off and then you go, you don't just endlessly watching this binging thing. So my brother and I, my older brother and I, where we were laughing one day, we were like, can you imagine if Netflix and these things existed when we were kids? He's like, it's endless amounts of TV. Like we wouldn't have done anything. We would have just tried to watch it all. So like, I don't feel I can't blame them because there's just endless amounts of stuff.
Yeah.
But I just come from a slightly different time when I'm like, I watch a show, when it's done, I turn it off. And then there's like another one, but just to sit there and endlessly watch binge shows. And then we actually didn't even have any streaming services until COVID hit.
That's true.
So,
that's true.
Yeah. Like we had cable TV and we would watch sports and different things. COVID hit and we were like, oh, I guess we'll get Netflix. And then we got Amazon Prime and then we got Disney show. And now we have these streaming shows. And, you know, like it's funny, like my son will be like, hey, let's watch something. And so we just tend to rewatch the shows that we like. And but it's, for every person, there's an enabler, and especially for, for kids and for people that are unhealthy and they're like, oh, I can't eat healthy. Yeah. Like there's an opportunity if you teach yourself to cook, right? Just like exercise. Like it's the thing about exercise is nobody can do it for you. You have to
listen, I saw an amazing thing last weekend before I left, and that was a Sydney marathon.
And is that where you live in Sydney?
Yeah, I live in the center of Sydney, right in the middle.
It's a beautiful place.
10,000 people. My wife and I, we walk through the gardens. We do 5Ks every day.
Nice.
And we were trying to cross the road into the Botanic Gardens in Sydney. And we had to sit there and wait for a gap with these 10,000. And they were kids. They were 15, 16, 17-year-olds, 20-year-olds. And they all had their white. They were as fit as you could see. And I think there are so many of these young kids now are into exercise. Yeah. And certainly in my country, sport is a big thing.
I think it's swinging back. You know, what's interesting on the pendulum, and like we've seen this, especially in this country, I think COVID and what happened was so polarizing that a lot of the kids saw a lot of the insanity and a lot of the lies and just a lot of the manipulation
Good point.
Is swinging back the other way. And the issue we're going to get now is we're going to get more kind of right-wing, I don't know, reactionary socialists. I mean, like the fact that, I don't know if you how big you are on any of the pop culture stuff, but, you know, Kanye West just recently came out
with
his new song that's basically, uses a derogatory term I'm not going to drop here, but ends in Heil Hitler.
Really?
I mean, here's a black rapper who's writing a song that's, you know, the chorus line has Heil Hitler in it. So, I mean, there's this interesting swinging of the pendulum. And I think things get so draconian and things swung so far this way that now you're going to swing back and it's not going to what people are going to looking for. I mean, we were very fortunate here during lockdown. I remember when my kids didn't go to school, but we had all this area. I mean, it wasn't a terrible time for us. Like I said, you're here at my office. Everybody showed up to work. It was fine. But for a lot of people, and especially like the video or the, the stories that we saw from New York and different places, and even the stories coming out of Australia looked like it was like a full, military incursion. They had cops in mass outside here and arresting people. And it just looked like a complete.
You'd be allowed out for 100 yards a day. You know, it's a bit like a jail.
Yeah. I mean, people were outside playing. People are calling the cops on them.
All based on nothing, based on false information.
But isn't it scary how easily people are manipulated and culled into this?
Absolutely. It's brainwashing and given various other terms. But I can't talk to doctors now, friends of mine, about ivermectin as being something they should be regularly treating, because the data now shows that the very expensive antivirals don't work. That just come out, a big study by the company, by Pfizer, showing that its favorite antiviral had zero effect, reflecting this dynamic change of between the patient experience, the virus changing, et cetera. And so you've got this total resistance now, pretty much.
And so they vilified you.
I've been rightly vilified. Have a read on my Wikipedia.
I don't put any trust in Wikipedia.
No.
But I mean, it's, this is what you've done your entire life.
Yeah, this is what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess you'll just keep fighting the good fight.
Let's try.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Doc, thank you so much for coming on Power Athlete Radio. I appreciate it.
Super pleasure. Super pleasure. See you back in Sydney sometime.
I will gladly come anytime you want to invite me. Hopefully there's a conference something I can come to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, awesome. I wasn't going to do it on... Hey there, Power Athlete Nation. Big shout out to all the heavy hitters who stuck around till the final whistle. If you've been soaking in the knowledge bombs and epic tales you've been dropping for free, here's your chance to be a game changer. Swing by klfi.com/powerathlete and toss a few bucks our way to keep the podcast fueled and firing on all cylinders. That's ko-fi.com/powerathlete. Your support makes a difference. See ya.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.